Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the second inauguration of President Obama that coincided with Martin Luther King Day and get an appraisal of the 44th president from James Kloppenberg, Professor of American History and Chair of the History Department at Harvard University. He's the author of Reading Obama, Dreams, Hope, and the American Political Tradition. And we will discuss the apparent comfort most Americans have with their first black president. Then we'll look into the president's second inaugural speech with a former chief speechwriter for the United States representative to the United Nations and author of Live from the Campaign Trail, the greatest presidential campaign speeches of the 20th century and how they shaped modern America. Michael Cohen joins us to discuss today's speech and how much it spelled out Obama's vision to address the challenges ahead as he enters his second term with a gridlocked Congress and a divided country. Then finally, we will look into the roiling region of North Africa, where the residue of terrorism from Algeria and arms from Libya are turning the Sahel into a new front in the war on terror. The former United States Ambassador to Mali, Vicky Huddleston, joins us. She had a recent article at the New York Times, Why We Must Help Mali. And we will discuss how neglect towards the region led to a belated effort to address a deteriorating situation that could have been more easily solved earlier. Joining us now is James Kloppenberg, the Charles Warren Professor of American History and Chair of the History Department at Harvard University. His books include Uncertain Victory, Social Democracy and Progressivism in European and American Thought, 1870 to 1920, The Virtues of Liberalism, A Companion to American Thought, and his latest book is Reading Obama, Dreams, Hope, and the American Political Tradition. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Kloppenberg.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Today's inauguration of the president and his much-anticipated speech, it seems in many ways to be a ringing defense of liberalism. It also invoked social responsibility and obligations of citizenship. What was your sense? My basic sense, James Kloppenberg, was watching the president, well, this is a man that's very comfortable in his skin. He's very comfortable in the presidency. And I also feel that most Americans are very comfortable with him as their first black president.
I think that's true. I think his reelection does, in some ways, stand as almost as great an achievement as his election in the first place, because the nation was in much worse shape in 2008, and a lot of people were simply voting against George W. Bush. This time, people had to take a good, solid look at Barack Obama and compare him with the alternative and returned him to office, even though the economy is still struggling and even though we still face a number of problems. So I think it is true that this is a kind of consolidation of the first term, and he still faces a very divided Congress and, to be fair, a divided nation. But I think you're quite right that there is overall much greater comfort with him than there was the first time around.
And how much do you think the president is in the sense that his agenda and the Democratic Party agenda, I guess, is really in the mainstream? And I think, obviously, a lot of it has to do with how extreme elements of the Republican Party has become. But you get the feeling that he is sort of turning a lot of Reaganism on its head by invoking American exceptionalism, not in a sort of jingoistic, militaristic sense, but in the sense that we can live up to our ideals and improve this country.
I think that's very well put. He began the speech by invoking both Thomas Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln. That phrase about blood drawn by the lash and by the sword is from Lincoln's second inaugural. And I think it is true that he's trying very hard to locate his version of a Democratic Party ideology in a long American tradition of collective action and togetherness, and to distinguish that way of thinking about American government from the Republican Party's emphasis on individualism and initiative. And I think he was much more direct in this inaugural than he was the first time around about the difference between between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. You'll remember that he was positioning himself as the first post-partisan president in that first inaugural, and he really was, I think, hoping for more cooperation from the Republicans than he got. This time he was pretty direct and said forthrightly that his administration was going to defend Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, and that those programs do not make us a nation of takers, to use the term that the Republicans favored from the summer on, but instead they free us to take the risks that make our nation great. And that, I think, is a very long-standing commitment of the Democratic Party, and he does well to reaffirm it, I think.
And James Kloppenberg, of course, the combination of diversity and opportunity is what he's arguing is what the American dream's about.
Exactly. One could almost have put E Pluribus Unum as the title both of the address and of the poem that Richard Blanco presented during the inauguration. I think it is the case that from Obama's point of view, the diversity that the Republican Party is so uneasy about is the greatest strength of the United States, both domestically and when we look overseas. The fact that we are a nation of nations should make it possible for us to see the value in diversity. And when he talked about the problems that the United States faces in the international domain, he was not calling for war, but instead for peace and for the resolution of difficulties. And again, that's a long-standing theme of his, but he put it very strongly and I think well today.
Again, I'm speaking with James Kloppenberg, the Charles Warren Professor of American History and Chair of the History Department at Harvard University and author of Reading Obama, Dreams, Hope, and the American Political Tradition. So as I now describe it in the Beltway as the optics, terrible word, but I'm being corrupted by the Beltway here. I thought the optics were quite stunning. I mean, first of all, he's an extremely attractive man and with a very attractive family. And then you had that the Kelly Clarkson singing America the Beautiful. And then you had that Cuban-American poet, beautiful reading of a poem. Mm-hmm. And then the top it all off, the finale was Beyonce, who's, of course, is gorgeous and knocked it out of the ballpark with a rendition of the national anthem. So, what was your reaction to the visuals?
Well, I think it couldn't have been orchestrated better. I mean, right down to the details of the attire of the first family and of Vice President Biden and his wife and daughter who were there. I think, as you said when you began, the entire event demonstrated the degree to which both the first family has become comfortable in that role and the degree to which America, most of America, has fallen in love with not only Barack Obama, but especially with Michelle Obama and with the two girls. So there was, I think, a very, very self-conscious attempt on their part to present themselves as an all-American family, and they pulled it off beautifully. I think you're quite right. Kelly Clarkson was doing a little bit of the sort of styling of a song that we have associated with the black musical tradition, and she actually did as much of it, if not more, than Beyonce did. I thought Beyonce showed wonderful restraint given the pyrotechnics she's capable of, and I think, again, was very deliberately mainstreaming African Americans into the American tradition in a way that would be palatable, I hope, not only to African Americans, but to that very large majority of whites, some of whom remain quite uneasy with the fact that African Americans are now in the White House. So I think it was put together with that in mind, and from my perspective, at least, it was very successful.
So, as the president faces a divided nation and a somewhat dysfunctional Congress, at least a gridlock Congress, what do you think his legislative strategy is going to be here? Because I think we may have a kind of indicator of it in this so-called fiscal cliff deal, that if he can get bills started in the Senate and then sent to the House for an up or down vote, which is not in itself an easy thing, there's a chance that he's with the Democrats and a few wavering Republicans that he can actually have some legislative accomplishments.
I think you're right that that will be the strategy. I think it's dependent in large part on the extent to which Speaker Boehner can keep his increasingly uneasy troops together on the Republican side of the aisle, because it does seem as though at least some Republicans realize that if they simply demonstrate the same intransigence they did in the second 2 years of the first term, that they are going to be marginalized and that they may well lose big in the next by-election in 2014. So I think he will attempt to deepen that rift in the Republican Party, but we can't tell yet whether he's going to have any success doing that or not. I think the other gambit that he will try, and he made clear already on the question of gun control, is the use of the executive power, which he did less of in the first term than some people thought he should. And I think there are certain things that he can do that harken back to the first president of the 20th century when he gave that speech that you and I talked about a while ago in Osawatomie, Kansas, which some people saw as the opening of the 2012 campaign just a little over a year ago. He was deliberately invoking Theodore Roosevelt, I think, because he wanted to suggest that there are things that a president can do, as Teddy Roosevelt did, outside the obstreperous Congress that opposed much of what Roosevelt wanted to do and much of what Obama has wanted to do. So I think that combination of working with the Senate, trying to put pressure on the House, and using executive authority when he has to will be the way he tries to go forward.
And James Kloppenberg, you mentioned his remark about we're not a nation of takers, which was seemed like a dig at Paul Ryan, who was fairly visible nearby. But he also said we cannot mistake absolutism for principle or substitute spectacle for politics or treat name-calling for reasoned debate. And that's pretty clear that he's talking about, I guess, the Tea Party, and he's also talking about the deterioration of discourse here in the country. He's got most people on his side, hasn't he? I mean, the approval of Congress is down to about 8%, my understanding is.
I think that's right, and I think he was very much assisted this morning by Colin Powell, who said much the same thing, that the Republican Party needs to return to the more moderate position it took during the presidency of Dwight Eisenhower and George H.W. Bush, and to call out those people who call themselves Republicans who really have become a radical right, rather than pretending that those people speak for the majority of Republicans and the majority of Americans. All the polls indicate that that's far from the truth, that the far right of the Republican Party speaks for no more than 20% of the American people. And I think as the polls have made that clear and as the re-election of the president affirmed, there is a large and growing majority behind programs not only like Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, but many of the programs that the Democratic Party has been pushing in the last 10 years. And the Republican Party had been pretending, I think, that everyone was on board with the Reagan Revolution and that that was a permanent transformation of American politics. But what the election and re-election of Bill Clinton and now the election and re-election of Barack Obama have indicated is that there is a very strong majority behind Democratic Party policies. And the question is going to be whether Barack Obama can consolidate that majority during the course of his second term.
But of course, it may well be that the Tea Party and the far right of the Republican Party's bark is worse than their bite. But when you consider how effective Karl Rove has been at organizing these people, getting a Republican majority in 2010, gerrymandering so thoroughly that in the last election, the Democrats in the House got substantially more votes than the Republicans, even though they've got the majority. And then you've got the fact that Rove is he may have made a fool of himself on election night, but he still re-signed his contract with Fox, so that machine is still in place. And so many of these people that were elected are more concerned about somebody even further to the right of them running against them in a primary than they are about dealing with America's problems.
Yeah, the gerrymandering of congressional seats in the last 10 or 15 years is a really serious problem for American democracy, because it means that more and more seats are safe Democratic seats or safe Republican seats, and that the only challenges are going to come from the left for the Democrats and from the right for the Republicans, which gives people incentive to move away from the center and toward the more extreme versions of their party's ideologies. And if we're going to get any movement across the aisle in Congress, that's a dynamic that somebody is going to have to address, and it's not at all clear how it can be addressed, especially since there's so much money to be made in the media by people who want to take the most extreme position they can take. And Karl Rove signing again with Fox News was a perfect illustration of that. There was no cost to his, from the point of view of many of us, absolutely irresponsible behavior on election night, the sort of thing you would not expect to see on a national network. So I think there is a lot of momentum that is pulling people both toward the far right and, I'd like to say, toward the left as well. And what might be happening is that the center, which is where the action has always been in American politics, is becoming more and more volatile and includes people who on particular issues are likelier to swing one direction or the other instead of staying consistently behind one party or the other. So that may mean that we'll see a continuation of the pattern of recent years of seeing pretty wide swings from one election to the next every 2 years. And so if Obama can consolidate his victory and can continue to make a persuasive case that the Republican Party is preventing the solution of the problems the nation faces, he might perhaps be able to cut into that Republican Party majority in the Congress. I'm sure that's the goal in the next 2 years, because if he goes into the last 2 years of his presidency without a majority in Congress, those last 2 years are likely to be very unsuccessful for him.
And of course, James Kloppenberg, that's all about the turnout in 2010. I think about half of the people voted in 2008. That was, in other words, all the Republicans showed up, but half the Democrats who showed up to elect Obama in the first place didn't. And he's got to reverse that clearly in 2014 and run like a president, hasn't he?
Exactly. And that's part of the reason why he's almost overnight turned the entire reelection apparatus into an electronic fundraising machine for the Democratic Party. And it's not specifically connected to the Democratic Party in most of what he's sending out to those of us who are on these email distribution lists, but it's very clear that they want to keep all of the people who were mobilized for the presidential election engaged with politics in the way that the Democratic Party used to do at the grassroots level when there were local offices that stayed in business. Now that those local offices hardly exist anymore, the best way to stay in touch with people is through the new media. And that, I think, is very much what he's going to try to do. The turnout in the presidential election in 2012 was a big surprise, I think, to a lot of people who were on the campaign trail and to many of the pundits who were predicting that because they perceived less enthusiasm on the part of the electorate than they had seen before, that there would be a lower turnout and that would be to the benefit of the Republican Party. But the voters turned out in numbers that were a surprise to people, and that's what put Barack Obama back in office. One of the things that we have to keep in mind about today is that even though there were far fewer people than turned out for the inauguration in 2008, it's still, I think, the estimates show, the second largest turnout for any inauguration in United States history. And so it depends on whether you're looking at the glass half empty or glass half full. It's not 2008, but neither is it any of the inaugurations before. And the reason for that is that there's still a great deal of enthusiasm for this man and for what he represents and for the programs that he would like to see put in place.
Well, just in closing, James Kloppenberg, not only is this the anniversary of Martin Luther King Day, as well as the inauguration, it's also the third anniversary of the Citizens United decision. And There is, not that I'm suggesting that Karl Rove was involved in that decision, but with these organizations like the American Legislative Exchange Council that he's organized or been a part of, along with the strategy that we talked about earlier that brought about the Republican victory in 2010, the impression is that they have strategy, and I'm not sure where the Democratic strategy is, and it's got to be more than an email list, surely.
Well, I think it does include a much more aggressive style on the part of the president, and I think we saw a little bit of that today. He's still arguing that there needs to be a partnership to solve problems, but I think he's not going to back down in the way that some of his most vociferous followers thought he did again and again during the first term. I think there is a much more aggressive style that we're beginning to see already and that we're going to see in the next 4 years. Whether that's enough to rally the troops, to keep them involved, I'm not quite sure. But one of the lessons of 2012, which was a big surprise to me and to many other people who thought that the Citizens United decision was going to be a catastrophe for the Democratic Party and for the left more generally, turned out that the Obama machine was able to raise an enormous amount of money, not from as big donors as the Republicans did, and Wall Street went for the Republicans this time instead of splitting and many people going for Obama as they did in 2008. But even without the big money, he was able to raise an enormous amount for his reelection campaign. So I'm with many people who would like to see really substantial campaign finance reform. But if that doesn't happen, I think that the Democratic Party simply has to continue doing what they did in this last election, and that is to beat the Republicans at their own game and outraise them and make use of the media that they do have an advantage with, and the new media, but also continue to use the more traditional print and television media effectively, so that this very sharp division between a form of individualism that Paul Ryan represents in his continuing invocations of Ayn Rand and the much more, traditional American focus on togetherness and what we can do in terms of the common purpose doesn't fade out of focus in the next 2 years before the next by-election.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, James Kloppenberg.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with James Kloppenberg, who's the Charles Warren Professor of American History and Chair of the History Department at Harvard University. His books include Uncertain Victory, Social Democracy and Progressivism in European and American Thought, 1870 to 1920, and The Virtues of Liberalism, A Companion to American Thought. And his latest book is Reading Obama, Dreams, Hope, and the American Political Tradition. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking further about the president's speech on his second inauguration. That's why I know you're my
just like the river I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Cohen, who's a U.S. columnist for The Guardian and author of Live from the Campaign Trail, The Greatest Presidential Campaign Speeches of the 20th Century and How They Shaped Modern America. He's a fellow of the Century Foundation and previously served in the United States Department of State as chief speechwriter for the U.S. representative to the United Nations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Cohen.
Thanks. Great to be here.
And what was your impression of the today's inauguration, the second inauguration of President Obama? Our previous guest was suggesting that this is a man that seems very comfortable in the presidency, and the American people are, by and large, quite comfortable with their first black president.
Yeah, I was very impressed surprised, I should say, by this speech and impressed by it. I wasn't expecting much. Inaugurals usually are not. They're disappointing or underwhelming, I should say. This one was not. This one was different, I think, in the sense that Obama didn't just sort of go for the platitudes and the banalities of national unity, but he really did sort of pitch a pretty progressive agenda, much more progressive than I think we've seen from him in the past, and more than I was expecting. And I think what he was sort of trying to do is sort of lay out this idea that, you know, there is national unity around the things that he thinks are important, around gay rights, around protecting social insurance programs, around climate change. So it was a way of sort of creating consensus around his agenda while also marginalizing Republicans. All in all, I thought it was a very effective speech.
And in the crafting of the speech, it seemed like he was sort of using the Constitution in a way as a kind of framework. He kept, you know, the refrain was, we the people, we the people.
Absolutely. And this is something he's done a lot. You know, he's been is always very effective at, and I think a lot of political speeches are effective in the U.S. if they are able to sort of orient themselves around the founding documents of the country. And if you go, if you think about the person who's being honored today with a national holiday, Martin Luther King, he, of course, did that in his I Have a Dream speech, in which he tried to cast the civil rights movement as a very sort of American movement and one that was directly descendant to the ideals in the Declaration of Independence. And I think that's a little bit what Obama did today. I mean, I think he really tried to pitch this notion that his sort of idea that, you know, collective action to solve great national challenges is very much grounded in our legacy and our history as a country. And that is, you know, I don't think it's a very radical concept. I think for American politics it's a little bit radical, I suppose. I think for Obama to say it, it's somewhat radical, because this is a guy who's been, you know, traditionally somewhat risk-averse, somewhat pragmatic, and today with somebody much bolder and much more progressive than we've seen before.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Cohen, who's a U.S. columnist for The Guardian and the author of Live from the Campaign Trail, The Greatest Presidential Campaign Speeches of the 20th Century and How They Shaped Modern America. He was served as a in the United States Department of State as a chief speechwriter for the U.S. representative to the United Nations. And in terms of the speech, part of the speech that got my attention, Michael Cohen, because yesterday I had the environmentalist and biologist on, Paul Ehrlich, talking about how global warming is baking Australia, and it's absolutely disastrous. He gave a very, very powerful and somewhat alarming prescription for what's happening to the world, and he's in the and of course most of the scientists, 99% of them agree with this. The science is there. This is you know, Australia is baking. The northeast is coast of the United States is flooding. It's quite manifest, and this could be the greatest challenge to facing the planet. And it does require a kind of Manhattan Project type invocation from a leader, or you know, in Jack Kennedy's case, putting a man on the moon. And I'm not suggesting that President Obama reached that level, but at least he didn't talk about it in the campaign trail, but he did say, and just quoting again the way the speech was framed, we the people still believe that our obligations as Americans are not just to ourselves, but to all posterity. We will respond to the threat of climate change, knowing that the failure to do so would betray our children and future generations. Some may still deny the overwhelming judgment of science, but none can avoid the devastating impact of raging fires and crippling drought and more powerful storms. So what was your sense of, is he laying down a marker there, or is that just rhetoric?
I mean, on a lot of these issues, I think it was more than rhetoric. I'm not convinced on climate change that it is, because, you know, he said a few weeks ago that this was an issue that there wasn't a lot of consensus in Congress to move forward on. There are things that he can do, you know, from the executive branch, but, you know, to get real movement on this issue, you need help from Congress. And I'm not sure I see where it's coming from. I also am not sure, with the president, you know, having to deal with two major fiscal challenges in the next 2 months, trying to move immigration reform forward, trying to do something on gun control. To do climate change also is a lot. I just don't know if there's going to be enough impetus to do it. And I agree with you. I mean, this to me is the number one challenge for Obama, for this country to deal with. And I'm glad he said it, but until I see a real proposal out there to move forward, I'm going to be suspicious that there's going to be a lot of action behind it.
Well, he was saying that, you know, that we, he said the path towards sustainable energy sources will be long and sometimes difficult, but Americans cannot resist this transition. We must lead it. Now, the challenge of global warming, you know, without being alarmist, is the greatest challenge facing mankind since, say, the nuclear holocaust was. And by the way, for 30 years, we live within 30 minutes of being wiped off the planet around the clock, and we don't anymore. So great changes are capable. But in this case, it's so easily identifiable, and with the constituency of denial out there, you would think a leader and the leader of the world, this is something that he's got to step up in with whether or not the Congress is going to do anything about it or not. This is a question about leadership.
I agree to an extent. I mean, I do agree with you that the president has to push this issue forward. You know, but having said that, at the same time, one thing about Obama that's been pretty clear is that he's a pragmatic guy. He'll choose his battles. And, you know, it's interesting he's moving forward to gun control, even though I think it's very hard to get a bill passed. I think it's very, very hard when you've got basically the entire Republican Party denying the science of global warming to move a bill, and a lot of, frankly, Democrats who are hesitant to push forward with the bill. I mean, I agree with you on the need for leadership. I agree with you that this is, as I said, I mean, you said before you don't want to be alarmist. No, you should be alarmist because this is a really serious crisis. I'm just questioning whether how aggressive he's going to be on this, because I don't know if there is that group in Congress that's going to be supportive of a bill. But, you know, I think you're right, though. That is much of a defense. I mean, this is such an important issue. He has to talk about it more and certainly do more than he just did today. And today was a good start. And I like the fact that he actually called out the climate denialists out there. That was a good thing to see him do. But he needs to go further on this. And we'll see if it happens. But one thing I will say is that he can do something on the executive level. He can do something with his executive powers, from a regulatory standpoint. And that'll be curious to see if he move forward on that in the near term, even if he can't get a bill through Congress.
So the other thing, Michael Cohen, the other aspect of the speech that I found pretty interesting, and I think he's bringing this is not an enunciated policy, and of course you've written speeches for the UN, the U.S. representative to the United Nations, so you know a lot about U.S. Policy and how it's enunciated. But he did say, and again quoting from his speech today, but we are also heirs to those who won the peace, and not just the war, who turned sworn enemies into the surest of friends. And we must carry those lessons into this time as well. We will show the courage to try and resolve our differences with other nations peacefully, not because we are naive about the dangers we face, but because engagement can more durably lift suspicion and fear. So I would say that might have been a signal to Iran. What was your response?
That was how I took that as well. That's not a new thing for Obama to say. I mean, he said that on the campaign trail in 2007, 2008. He certainly said it before. In a way, it sets a nice tone for a second-term foreign policy, to talk about the need to for diplomacy and for negotiation and to turn sort of our back on this perpetual war that we've sort of experienced the last 10 years. Look, I've always thought this president has no interest whatsoever in going to war against Iran, and that everything he's done over the past 4 years has been to try to prevent a war from happening. I still think that's true. I still think, that's his goal. So today I don't see it changing much, but it's good for, I think it's good for him to remind people about where his sort of mindset is. But I look at this president as somebody, I look from who he picked for Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense, as somebody who is taking a long, hard look at U.S. overseas commitments and the sort of fetishization, if you will, of our military, and he's taking a step back from that. I think it's a good thing and long overdue.
Well, the fact that he's chosen people that have actually fought in the Vietnam War and who have come to recognize the folly of that war, as opposed to the reckless, utopian militarism of the neoconservatives. And, of course, George W. didn't serve in Vietnam. But it seems like so many of our presidents who have not served in the military get overwhelmed by the military and get seduced in the way that some of our journalists get seduced when yeah. they're embedded with the military. And, you know, people like Bill Clinton, who never served and was very defensive about that fact, and a whole slew of them, Ronald Reagan, of course, being famous, having only been served in the movies, but not in World
right.
War II. So the fact that he's got these Chuck Hagel and John Kerry there in these important roles indicates to me that maybe there's going to be a change. What's your sense?
Well, look, I think I think the point you make is a great one about presidents being seduced by the military, especially ones who never served. I think any seduction that existed between the military and Obama ended around 2010, 2009, after the Afghan review in fall of 2009, in which Obama definitely felt as if he was being boxed in by the military, which he was. And, you know, if you look at what his sort of response out of the past couple of years, it's definitely been to sort of take military advice and take military advocacy with a grain of salt. In a way, I think that's his mindset for a while. I mean, he rejected their advice on Afghanistan. And I think, you know, he'll probably reject it even further as we go forward with the drawdown from there. And I think I would, you know, view that as well as the selection to be like Hagel and Kerry, who seem very suspicious of foreign entanglements, as a sign that Obama's going to do what he wants in foreign policy. He's not going to be guided by the military. That, by the way, you know, it's a great point. This is a really big shift, I would say. You know, a president who definitely sort of holds the military at an arm's length a little bit, especially someone who never served, especially when he's a Democrat. But that's my sense of Obama at this point, that he is very much going to fashion his own course on foreign policy, you know, whatever the uniform military says. And it's their own fault, frankly, because I think they burned him on Afghanistan. I think he feels burned. I think he feels like he needs to take his own counsel on these issues.
Well, I think specifically, though, Michael Cohen, I don't know that it was the entire American military that burned him so much as Petraeus. I mean,
I'm sorry, senior officer corps. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, because yeah. I think so much of the American military, the top brass and the enlisted men, all the way down the enlisted men, did not like Iraq and did not like Afghanistan. They thought they were disastrous. I mean, I think if you did a real poll, you'd find, you know, but for the Tommy Franks of this world, most of them thought it was a bad idea.
But if you look back and say what happened in Afghanistan, again, I'm looking back on this is 3 years now, but the Afghan surge review, this was in fall of 2009, he was getting a lot of pressure from the military, you know, from Petraeus, from McChrystal, from others, to push forward with from Mike Mullen, to push forward with the surge, and I think there was a sense in the White House they were being boxed in. And I think, you know, again, I don't want to speak for all more than a million members of the military. I think it's more a question that Obama is more reluctant to, or more hesitant to take the advice of, you know, his military aides as he might have been 3-4 years ago. That 3-4 years ago, he might have been intimidated by them and felt that he, you know, only had so much wiggle room to operate vis-a-vis the military, and I think maybe now he feels he has a little more options at his disposal, and a little more confidence, frankly, a little more confidence in his own decision making and his own ability to manage U.S. foreign policy.
Well, indeed, his first national security advisor was a general who was apparently somewhat disrespectful towards him, you know, so he certainly learned a lot on the job, and he seems to. I mean, just going back to my original point, this man seems to be a man that's very comfortable being president.
I agree.
And I think, but you were saying earlier, you think he's going to be more assertive?
I mean, look, if today's any indication, I think so. And I think if you look what's happened over the past few weeks on gun control, on the debt limit issue, I mean, not getting enough coverage. But the debt limit issue basically, he didn't blink. He called the Republicans bluff, and they blinked. And they basically surrender on the debt limit. He's been much more assertive, much more aggressive than I think anyone would have expected. And I think it leaves Republicans in a tough spot because, you know, think of the gun control issue as an example of this. I mean, he can push forward with this stuff and they may reject it. They're going to pay a big political price for doing so. And I think, you know, if you're Obama, you're now feeling, you know, that you can push forward with your agenda and be aggressive, knowing that there's a political payoff for doing so, even if you lose. I think that's a little bit what you're seeing now.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Michael Cohen.
Always a pleasure, man. Thank you for having
me. Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Michael Cohen, who's a U.S. columnist for The Guardian and author of Live from the Campaign Trail, The Greatest Presidential Campaign Speeches of the 20th Century and How They Shaped Modern America. He's a fellow of the Century Foundation and previously served in the United States Department of State as chief speechwriter for the U.S. representative to the United Nations. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the former U.S. ambassador to Mali.
And it feels like,
feels like,
and it seems like,
seems like,
and it feels like,
feels like
a brand new day, a brand new day, yeah.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ambassador Vicki Huddleston, who served as a career diplomat in Africa and Latin America. She was a U.S. ambassador to Madagascar and to Mali, as well as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Africa, and was the chief U.S. diplomat in Cuba from 1999 to 2002, and Deputy Chief of Mission in Port-au-Prince, Haiti from 1994 to 1995. She has received various Department of State awards, including the Distinguished Medal of Honor, Distinguished Honor Award, and a Presidential Meritorious Service Award. She recently had an op-ed in the New York Times, Why We Must Help Save Mali. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Vicki Huddleston.
Hi, Ian. Nice to be with you.
And I was wanting to get a broader sense of what's roiling the region of North Africa, where clearly there is residue from the terrorism, residue of terrorism from Algeria going back to the bloody civil war there. And, of course, the recent influx of arms from Libya appear to be turning the Sahel into a new front in the war on terror. You were speaking with me earlier, and you said that much of this could have been avoided, but our attention has been elsewhere, Iraq, Afghanistan, etc., and we're somewhat, too little too late, and this could have been solved a lot earlier. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, that's a fair assessment, and it's really very sad. And, of course, as you say, there was Iraq, there was Afghanistan, there was Yemen, there was Somalia. But when you look at it and you say, look what has happened. These jihadist extremists now control an area that's the size of France in northern Mali, and they operate with impunity from the Atlantic Ocean in Mauritania, up through Algeria, where they took the hostages at the BP gas plant, across into Libya, where they're getting their weapons, and then down through Chad, Niger, Mali, and they have even linked up with the bloody Boko Haram that blew up the UN headquarters. How did we let it happen?
Well, it's in just speaking of Nigeria for a second, some of the troops that were heading from Nigeria to be deployed in Mali were killed in Nigeria, apparently by an Islamist group. I don't know what it was, Boko Haram, but...
Undoubtedly. It was undoubtedly Boko Haram in the north, and that's one of the things, actually, kind of to jump ahead to the solution that really worries me. It's wonderful that the West African troops, the West African Economic Community has gotten behind this. They're willing to give troops. But Nigeria is not the country to lead this. Nigeria has dealt very, very poorly with their own insurgency, the Boko Haram, which is linked to the Al-Qaeda franchise in Mali. They, in fact, have probably created more terrorists than would have been terrorists in their brutal methods of suppressing it. They should be part of the solution, but we need to have France or Algeria lead this effort. We need a country that has real military capacity. And the only countries in Africa that really have that kind of capacity are the North African countries and Ethiopia. But Ethiopia has its hands full in Sudan.
So what's it come down to? What African country can substitute for France?
Algeria. Algeria is the solution, not just to the military problem, which is defeat this Al-Qaeda terrorist group that should have been defeated long ago, 10 years ago, in fact, when they had 200 disaffected troops who had come into Mali because they were running from being defeated after a 10-year civil war in Algeria. But instead of defeating them or helping the country to defeat them, we tried to contain them. And you cannot contain terrorism. It has to be defeated. So Algeria is the key. They know the area. These are their terrorists, if you will, and they have a thoroughly professional military that can do the job, as we saw in the case of the hostage crisis.
Again, I'm speaking with Ambassador Vicki Huddleston, who is a career diplomat in Africa and Latin America. She was U.S. Ambassador to Madagascar and to Mali and was Deputy Assistant Secretary for Africa. And we're talking about the roiling area in North Africa, the Sahel, as it's called, where largely the Tuareg people are. And there is a sort of something of a disconnect from what I understand. We in the West see our intervention, or France's intervention in Mali, as a way to stop Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. But to the Malians, they see it as an intervention to stop the Tuareg, don't they?
No, I would correct that a little bit. I mean, it's partially true, but if I could spend a moment in talking about that, the real serious problem is the Al-Qaeda franchise. You mentioned Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, and that has to be defeated. It's a remnant of the civil war. It has grown strong and powerful with taking hostages, Western hostages, as one of the jihadis said. The West is playing for the jihad because the West has paid over $90 million for those hostages. It's taken over the smuggling routes, so it has the arms that came out of Libya when Gaddafi fell. So this jihadi movement that was once 200 is probably 2,000 with extremists from around Africa and around the world who have experience and they're capable fighters. Now what happened is that the Tuaregs that you mentioned, who are the nomads of northern Mali, they linked up, their rebel movements linked up with this Al-Qaeda franchise, thinking this was a way that they would be able to gain independence. The Tuaregs are a nomadic group from North Africa that, along with the Berberish, the Arabs, the Kuntas, who live north of the Niger River and extend in an area. They're not just isolated in Mali. They extend in an area that includes Niger, Libya, Algeria, and Chad, that they, since independence, have had four rebellions since Mali's independence, have had four rebellions for their own independence. They need to have some form of autonomy, because Mali is the poorest country, one of the poorest countries in the world. The north is even poorer. These are nomads, North Africans, speak Arabic, Tamashek, are completely different than the sub-Saharan Malians, who are 90% of the population and control all the levers of power. So they need to have a form of independence to satisfy their desires, and with that, they could form a defense group that would be mentored by the African Union troops and could begin to police this area. I really think that's the only solution, but we do have to recognize that Tuaregs and the other groups up there have legitimate grievances.
So, Ambassador Vicki Huddleston, again, former U.S. ambassador to Mali. But the idea of working with Algeria now. My understanding of the history was that there were about a decade ago there was an election in which the Islamic Salvation Front looked like they were going to win, and the elections were cancelled, that's led to a bloody civil war where the Algerian military government fought. I think at least 200,000 people died. The Islamists themselves became, whatever their original political intentions were in terms of the Islamic Salvation Front, they turned into absolute dead enders and the most psychotic, murderous group that one can imagine. There was a very interesting a movie that I saw about it some time back about a bunch of monks being captured by them.
Excellent movie.
Yeah, it was really, and I think it told the story about the insanity of these people. Now, they got driven into, across the southern border of Algeria into Mali, and you're saying that they were not finished off, but how can we, the United States, deal with this government in Algeria? Isn't that it's a security state. It's not a democratic government. Or is this situation beyond the niceties of democracy?
Oh, well, I think you're being a bit harsh. I mean, your history is great, but I think, Ian, you're being a little harsh on the Algerian government. What you're talking about is 20 years ago.
Right.
The Algerian Civil War ended in 2002 after 10 bloody years, and the government has evolved and it's greatly improved. I'm not going to say it's a democracy, but you look at North Africa, there were no democracies in North Africa. Now Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya have been overthrown. They're all struggling with some form of democracy. Algeria remains a semi-autocratic state. And Morocco is still a monarchy, but a liberalizing monarchy. But one of the major problems now is North Africa is no longer strong. And so that means that terrorism can take more root in that area, extremism can take more root in that area, and then it can hook up with, as it has, in fact, in Mali and carry out these terrorist attacks. So is Algeria a perfect government? No. Is it representative of what we saw in North Africa prior to the Arab Spring? Yes, only better. Can they deal with this problem in cooperation with France, in cooperation with ourselves and with African troops? I believe they can. I think they would be an excellent co-leader. If we want to keep Nigeria to represent the West Africa, then why not a co-lead with Algeria?
Now, didn't the Algerian government support Gaddafi and Habari's people? I mean, they weren't happy about the U.S. intervention there, were they?
Actually, that's a great point. They were very, very unhappy. But the reason they were very, very unhappy, and nobody really talked about it, and I don't think anybody really understood, they saw exactly what was going to happen. Because Gaddafi kept the peace in northern Mali. What he did with the Malian government is arrange with the Tuaregs to have a certain clan be in charge of the area. And those who didn't like it were invited to go up to Libya and enter in Gaddafi's army. So Gaddafi had lots of Tuareg troops and obviously Berbish and Arab as well. And when Gaddafi fell, and I think the Libya war was a humanitarian war that was a good thing to see the end of a cruel dictator like Gaddafi. But let's face it, when his armories opened up, those arms poured into Mali. It was as if everything was ready. Already you had the Al-Qaeda franchise with their guns, with their money from their kidnapping, with the control of the trade routes. You had a rebellion brewing from the Tuaregs, and like sort of this big blister blowing up, and then suddenly Libya's weapons and Tuaregs come back. they light the fuse or they prick the blister, and the evil just flows out throughout Molly.
And how, just to get a sense of what can be done, and I'm not aware that the Algerian government are offering any, but maybe this incident that just took place may bring them to recognize that they do have a security problem on their southern border. Not that presumably they know that, but the Moroccans have been at war with the Polisarios in the south, haven't they, for a long, long time, and that hasn't. They haven't been able to contain that, have they, or at least have any victory?
Well, you know, this is one of the most complex issues, not just in Africa, but in the world, because Algeria and Morocco, because of Spanish Sierra, Sahrawi, don't get along at all. And you have some of the terrorists now that are extremists have come actually from Sahrawi in to join the Al-Qaeda extremists. But the thing about Algeria is that Algeria has been hesitant to get into this, but yet it was Algeria that set up the cell of Mauritania, Mali, Niger to confront and defeat the Al-Qaeda terrorists in the Sahel. Unfortunately, they weren't very effective. They weren't very effective because we failed to provide them with the intelligence. We were unwilling to, we were willing to train the Malians, but we weren't willing to mentor them or go with them into patrolling to make sure that they were actually carrying out a strategic plan. We didn't work in an effective regional basis. So Algeria worked on this a little bit, but they wouldn't go into Mali. Even though the Malians said, you can come in, you can go after these terrorists, but Algeria refused to do so. Some people say they did that because they wanted to keep them in northern Mali, because their goal, their original goal, has always been to overthrow the Algerian government, which goes back to what you said originally, when the Algerian military closed down the elections because they were afraid that...
Sure.
Extremists would win.
Well, Ambassador Vicky Huddleston, I hope we can have another conversation, because I can tell there's a lot more to learn about this, and I thank you so much for joining us.
Ian, it's been great, and I look forward to the next time.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Ambassador Vicky Huddleston, who served as a career diplomat in Africa and Latin America. She was U.S. Ambassador to Madagascar and Mali, as well as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Africa, as well as Chief U.S. Diplomat in Cuba and Deputy Chief of Mission in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. And she has an op-ed, or recently had an op-ed in the New York Times, Why We Must Help Save Mali. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/IanMastersMedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.